So, like Turkey itself, U.S.-Turkey relations have navigated remarkable transitions over the past 50 years. Today, you could say we're living in maybe the most exciting period. Time-worn cliches about Turkey, such as bulwark against the Soviet Union, or NATO allies since the Korean War, or bridge between East and West, are now being updated with new concepts like energy hub and vibrant emerging market. Of course, all those cliches retain some degree of truth, but they also reflect a static and simplified view of U.S.-Turkish relations. Today, the U.S. government's appreciation of Turkey's geostrategic significance is evolving in new and positive ways. Today, we're starting to understand Turkey's multiple identities. Turkey is not merely a bridge. It's a society whose soul lies in both East and West, with a strategic and cultural reach. Thank you. I'm not going to do a presentation, but anyway. With a strategic and cultural reach that extends from Pakistan, Afghanistan, Central Asia, and the Caucasus to the Balkans, Berlin, and Amsterdam. At the same time, Turkey is a strategic link between North and South, which we often don't think about, lying as it does at the center of an extended Black Sea region that connects the European Union, Russia, and the Ukraine, and the Middle East. Today, with a more sophisticated appreciation of Turkey's economic, diplomatic, and cultural might, the United States enjoys new opportunities to pursue the shared interests and common values that unite our two great countries. No factor is more significant in elevating Turkey's strategic significance and strategic relevance today than its vibrant and, well, own style of democracy. Turkey's constitutional principles of democracy, secularism, and the rule of law can inspire reformers in the broader Middle East and well beyond who seek the same political and economic freedoms and the same opportunities to improve their societies as enjoy the citizens of the Turkish Republic. We're therefore in the process of updating our own strategic concepts within the U.S. government. To understand more deeply the opportunities before us in this regard, it's probably useful to take a look backward, as Soner suggested, at how our strategic partnership or our relationship with Turkey has evolved over the past decade. During the 1990s, Turkey began fully to enjoy the fruits of Turgut Özal's groundbreaking reforms, and Prime Minister Erdogan has continued this important reform effort. Back in the 90s, we recognized an opportunity to build a new relationship between Ankara and Washington. The Cold War concept of Turkey as NATO's southern flank, blunting an attack by the Warsaw Pact and the Soviet Union, clearly became outdated with the downfall of the Soviet Union. At the same time, Turkey's economy grew as those reforms kicked in, Turkey's demand for energy grew, and Turkey's own aspirations to play a role in reconnecting the Turkic peoples to Turkey's east in the Caucasus and Central Asia became a powerful driving factor. At the same time, we in the United States recognized that there was a positive role for Turkey to play in this regard as a regional locomotive of economic growth and as a positive element in helping the Caucasus and Central Asia not only stabilize and not only evolve out of their Soviet past and into the real world, or our world, but to be connected in tangible ways, economically, politically, but also physically. And it was that physical connection then that gave birth to this idea of an East-West energy corridor. Presidents at the time, Süleyman Demirel, Edward Shevardnadze, Haydar Aliyev, also Nursultan Nazarbayev, as well as Saparmurat Niyazov across the Caspian Sea, had their own vision, which was to restore the Great Silk Road. They even used that terminology through massive energy infrastructure projects. It's important to note that this was the vision of those leaders. This was not the U.S. vision. This was the vision of Demirel, Shevardnadze, Aliyev, Nazarbayev, Niyazov. I'm not sure what vision he had, but anyway, he was somewhere on the horizon. And we came in later. The United States came in as a facilitator and as an actor that agreed with that vision and tried to help these new countries establish, well, a common strategic vision that would serve our interests as well. And so, U.S.-Turkey strategic partnership was born, with the centerpiece being energy cooperation in the form of, as we all know, the Baku-Tbilisi-Ceyhan oil pipeline and the South Caucasus gas pipeline, or the Baku-Tbilisi-Erzurum gas pipeline. At the same time, quite relevant for today's discussion, Turkey was developing a strategic partnership with Israel, bringing together the Middle East's only two democracies at that time to pursue their common security and economic interests. And I say at that time because we like to think that Iraq is also becoming a democracy. In terms of the cornerstones, though, of democracy in the Middle East, it's Turkey, it's Israel, and nearby, the first democracy in the region, Azerbaijan, which is still in the process of evolving its democratic institutions. So at the outset of this administration, of President George W. Bush's administration, we sought to build on the strong energy cooperation that had evolved in the previous administration of President Clinton. And we hoped we were going to be able to generate a deeper, more profound strategic dynamic between the countries of the Caspian Basin, Turkey, and Europe. What we did then was simply reorganize bureaucratically the way we ran the National Security Council and the State Department and ultimately the Pentagon to generate bureaucratic structures that reflected this vision. And the vision was, again, to follow the pathway of those pipelines to help Central Asian states and the Caucasus cement their independence and connect themselves with European and global markets through the gateway that is and remains Turkey. And so in the beginning, we were talking about pipelines, and we were thinking through in those early days of the Bush administration how we could do more. What could we do politically? What could we do in security terms to strengthen this dynamic, this East-West dynamic? And unfortunately, September 11th happened. And I just will never forget my own moment sitting there in the White House being told a plane was coming for us, and don't walk, run, and don't bother locking up the classified information, which anyone in the government knows is never what we're told. Don't turn off the computers, just run, because there's a plane coming. Shocking. Thank God for us, that plane ended up not coming where it was. Probably it could have been tragedy for others. In any case, I remember as I was running out the door thinking, oh my God, this east-west corridor we've been talking about becomes everything. Because we had a pretty good idea. Things were happening in Afghanistan. That's where this was coming from. You recall Massoud, a Northern Alliance leader, was killed just the day before, 2 days before. Something was happening in Afghanistan. And suddenly, the way we were going to respond, I just knew was going to be through this east-west corridor that was evolving. And, well, indeed, that is what happened. It is that very pathway of this east-west corridor stretching from the Black Sea and Turkey through Georgia, Azerbaijan, across the Caspian Sea and into Turkmenistan, as well as around the horn, Uzbekistan, Kyrgyzstan, that became the corridor that allowed us to launch and sustain Operation Enduring Freedom. That operation would have been impossible without that corridor, and I don't know how we would sustain it today. We would at enormous cost, but colleagues like Harold or others in the Pentagon would know how very difficult it would be without that corridor. So we actually were onto something when we thought of Turkey as this gateway to a more profound strategic corridor linking global markets in Europe all the way up to the Afghan border and Pakistan and beyond. Turkey's contributions to the war in Afghanistan then grew much deeper than simply being the gateway. Turkey, as you know, has now commanded the International Security Assistance Force, or ISAF, in Afghanistan twice. Very distinguished statesman, former Speaker of the Turkish Grand National Assembly, Foreign Minister Hikmet Çetin, served as NATO's civilian representative in Afghanistan. Turkey, as we know now, also commands a provincial reconstruction team in Vardak province, north of Kabul. And so our cooperation on Afghanistan is now emerging as a new cornerstone in a truly strategic partnership between the U.S. and Turkey. I'll talk more about Afghanistan in a little bit. But it was really quite good that we had established a security foundation or a foundation of security cooperation in Afghanistan, given what came afterward in the case of the war in Iraq. In 2002, many of us in this room had a very optimistic, hopeful vision that Turkey was on the verge of emerging as one of our most significant, operationally significant allies. I remember giving a talk on Capitol Hill back in this period where maybe overzealously I said, oh my goodness, it seems that perhaps, I didn't say oh my goodness, but it seems that Turkey can emerge at the same level of operational significance as the United Kingdom in terms of our allies, because we saw and assumed, maybe that was our fault, but we assumed that Turkey was going to be the crucial partner in advancing what became Operation Iraqi Freedom. Scholars will long debate what happened on March 1st, 2003. I'm not here to do that today, although I hope some of you will provide me your views at the end of my talk. The bottom line, though, is that the Turkish Parliament exercised its own sovereign right, a sovereign decision, to decline our request to move U.S. troops and equipment through Turkey on the way to Iraq. Sovereign decision. Unfortunately, that decision led to a series of events that sent our relationship into a tailspin and, I'd argue, really shattered a concept of strategic partnership. At the time, I think we were slow to realize that. At the time, some of us were frantic, saying, my goodness, before this particular decision is set in concrete, let's get back in a very serious engagement with our friends, our allies in Ankara, and see if we can't get another vote to take place, a vote that perhaps would reflect what we thought were the objectives of the government of Turkey, of the entire society. That didn't happen. Still, we worked hard to salvage U.S.-Turkey relations. You may recall before that decision, we had been offering an $8 billion assistance program, which could have expanded to $23 billion through loan guarantees. The idea was not to buy Turkey. I remember the cartoons at the time that were not so generous. It suggested the United States was trying to purchase Turkey's goodwill. That was never the intention. Our intention, and I know from being in the middle of these deliberations for months, our intention was to be respectful of our ally and to be caring about our ally, because we knew wars are disruptive phenomena, and if on Turkey's southern border there is a war underway, there could be exogenous economic forces created that could destabilize the Turkish economy. It's the last thing we wanted. So we thought, wow, this could be a relatively low-cost way to signal the market that we are not simply going to let the Turkish economy drift toward instability if there is or when there is a war in Iraq. So it was actually a fully well-intended goodwill gesture by an ally to try to keep the Turkish economy stable. It wasn't interpreted quite that way. Still, even after the vote on March 1st, you may recall, the U.S. government still offered $1 billion, simple grant, $1 billion, for nothing, just simply because we wanted to, again, signal the market that, no strings attached, really, signal the market that Turkey was not going to be left alone. There was some debate about whether there really were strings attached. I mean, the only conditions on that money was that Turkey not invade northern Iraq unilaterally, which it wasn't going to do anyway, right? And that Turkey continues with its IMF-mandated reforms. So from our perspective, there were no real conditions, although Congress, not the administration, set those conditions. But basically, the conditions were that Turkey should just do what it was planning to do anyway. Again, that got misinterpreted. We also had, at the end of 2003, in October, an offer, a generous offer by the Turkish government to send troops to Iraq, to Operation Iraqi Freedom. For a number of reasons, we decided that that wasn't necessarily the best thing to do. At the same time, the Turkish government decided accepting our $1 billion wasn't the best thing to do, so we moved on. That brought us to 2004. I promise I won't go year by year, month by month. I'll go faster. But it's important to think back to what the year 2004 meant to us in the administration as we thought through our strategy for the next couple of years. 2004 had three beautiful points on the timeline. One was Prime Minister Erdogan's visit to the Oval Office in January. 6 months later, right in the middle of the year, we had the Sea Island G8 summit, to which the Prime Minister was invited to help the G8 leaders better understand what it means to advance political and economic reform in the broader Middle East. Then, a couple weeks later, Turkey hosted the NATO summit in Istanbul, which I'll never forget the musical and cultural presentation at Topkapi, right in front of the Sublime Port. And I remember afterward, it was just a beautiful treatment of Janissary bands and Anatolian music and modern jazz. And I had the honor to see the Prime Minister on the way out, and I said, my God, if that didn't convince the European Union that you share these European values and have the strategic importance, I say with deference to my dear friend from French Embassy, I don't know what will. So it was really a stirring performance, and had an impact. It had an impact because then the third event of the year was what? It was the European Council decision in December that talks with Turkey would begin the next year, as they did in October 2005. And then, you know, there was a condition in 2005, the Ankara Protocol, opening up Turkish ports to Greek Cypriot shipping. But 2004 ended up being a very positive year with three big events on the calendar, and we planned it that way. We actually had a vision, and I would say it worked. Still, our relations were troubled by the PKK problem and our failure to implement our pledges to take concrete action to eliminate the PKK terrorist threat in northern Iraq. We had a policy and have a policy. It's like Gertrude Stein, you know, a rose is a rose is a rose. A terrorist is a terrorist is a terrorist. And if there is haven offered to a terrorist, those offering the safe haven are part of the problem as well. So when suddenly we saw what was happening, that PKK was using northern Iraq as its haven, we were in difficulty in terms of our own policy, and we had to find a way to take action. And we were absolutely sincere in our desire to do it. We did make some progress in Europe, where our team did assemble some serious measures to undercut the PKK's financial and operational support mechanisms in Europe. I think we began to change attitudes in Europe about PKK, and I think that because then Foreign Minister Gül was gracious enough to say so publicly a couple of times. But obviously, that wasn't enough because the popularity rating of the United States plummeted to 9%. I guess it's up to 12 now, so we've improved by 33%, but still not where it needs to be. But the improvement, I would say, I think we might all agree, began with the decisive meeting on November 5th, 2007, in the Oval Office. That meeting between President Bush and Prime Minister Erdogan really was a decisive turning point. President Bush's designation of the PKK as an enemy of Turkey, an enemy of Iraq, and therefore an enemy of the United States signaled a new approach by Washington in a very powerful way. We had never talked that way about PKK. And in addition to that, the intensive information sharing then that President Bush authorized, knowing full well that that information is going to be used operationally, signaled a new chapter in security cooperation between the United States, Turkey, and Iraq. And anybody who worked in the administration or previous administrations on this issue knows how difficult it was to authorize this sort of information sharing. It took a long time. But when it happened, that information sharing cleared the way for deeper cooperation, not only on security, but across the board on energy and on democracy as well. So that's the historical context. I promised I wouldn't go through year by year. But with that in mind, then I can turn to what Soner also suggested I do, which is look forward. Or at least look to where we are today in the next couple of years. I can't promise you 10 years, but I can promise you now and the next, at least certainly the end of the administration, and I hope the next administration will share the same views, because I think you'll see these objectives are enduring when it comes to U.S.-Turkish relations, and no surprises here. Back in July of 2006, you recall that then Foreign Minister Gül and Secretary Rice concluded the so-called shared vision document that we negotiated collaboratively and closely with our dear friends in Turkish Ministry of Foreign Affairs and in the embassy here. That document outlines a structured dialogue between our foreign ministries and our governments in pursuit of strategic interests and values that our two countries share. I won't go through all of the specific elements of the shared vision document, and you can look it up on the web, but I just want you to know that there is a piece of paper out there that we consciously negotiated to provide a framework and a roadmap for how we rebuild the U.S.-Turkish relationship and make it truly strategic. And if you look at the elements in it, you'll see the elements are grouped in three basic categories: energy and the economy, security cooperation, and democracy, democratic and market economic reform. So I already talked about energy in the 1990s and how that created a foundation for a partnership, but also was a first phase in developing a network of pipelines that could help global markets and Europe in the first instance diversify their supplies of oil and gas. Today now, we're focusing on the next phase. We're trying to expand that infrastructure, use the South Caucasus gas pipeline to lay the foundation for large volumes of gas from Azerbaijan onward into Europe through the Turkey-Greece-Italy, or TGI, pipeline, and the Nabucco pipeline. And Any of you who've had the bad fortune to hear me talk about energy in the last couple of years, you know the Nabucco pipeline. It will connect Turkey and Bulgaria, Romania, Hungary, and Austria to, first and foremost, Azerbaijan. And then gas beyond, hopefully, on the other side of the Caspian Sea, as well as Iraq. Azerbaijan has plenty of gas, in theory, to realize these projects. The question is, will it be ready at the right time to meet the needs of the investors? And I don't know what the answer to that question is. It depends on the time frames of the investors. Will they slow down the pipeline projects to have them ready in time for Azerbaijan's gas? Or will Azerbaijan accelerate its gas production? And will we be successful in advancing cooperation on gas exports from the other side of the Caspian and from Iraq? What I do know, I don't know the answer to those questions. I hope it's yes. What I do know is that if and when we do succeed, the Turkey, Greece, Italy, and Nabucco pipelines will be providing about 44 billion cubic meters of gas to Europe. I won't use a lot of numbers in this presentation, but 44 BCM. How does that compare to Gazprom? Gazprom now provides about 160 billion cubic meters of gas a year to Europe. So what we're talking about from hopefully just from Azerbaijan, but probably from other countries in the neighborhood, would add an equivalent of 25% of all the gas that the world's largest energy company, Gazprom, currently imports into Europe. That's significant. That's very significant if our goal is to make sure there's more competition for European gas markets so that it is market forces rather than monopolists who determine gas price in Europe. I won't torture you with a lot of detail. I just want you to remember that the goal here is not to displace Russia. It's not to contain Russia. It's not to damage Gazprom. It's to make sure that market forces and not monopolists determine the gas price in Europe. And there is a strong effort underway for things to be otherwise. for one company that provides 25% of all the gas that Europeans consume and 65% of the gas that Turkey consumes and 100% of the gas that the Baltic states and Poland consumes, strong effort by that company to maintain that market dominant position. And what we're saying is we would like to compel that company to act in a more market-based way by relying on market forces. And the way you do that is you create more competition, and Turkey is right in the middle of this effort to create that greater market competition. It is the connecting point between Caspian and Iraq and European markets. There's a negotiation going on between Azerbaijan and Turkey about the terms of gas transit across Turkey and the volume of gas that will move across Turkey. I will simply say that it seems to be going pretty well. President Aliyev and Prime Minister Erdogan met, as you may know, a couple weeks ago in Nakhichevan. And since then, it seems there's some momentum moving toward resolution of this commercial issue. That is very, very good news. For a moment, I'll talk about Iraq and gas production there. I have the great honor to be the U.S. co-chair of the Turkey-Iraq-U.S. Natural Gas Working Group on Iraq. Our goal is to help the Iraqi government realize what it says its own objective is, which is to attract enough investment quickly enough to take care of Iraq's domestic natural gas needs and to have gas left over for export into Turkey and onward into the Nabucco pipeline. Easier said than done. So many elements have to fall into place to make that happen. A hydrocarbon law, finally, one of these days needs to be promulgated in Baghdad so that there can be freer development and commercial operations in northern Iraq. But in western Iraq, there's already a major field, the Akkas field, that has been preliminarily drilled by the Syrians in the Saddam era. And we hope, working together with our Turkish allies, that we can convince the Iraqi government to accelerate development of that field and then figure out the best way to export that gas, either through the Arab pipeline that transits Syria, or what is becoming, I think, a preferred option would be to bring that gas back toward Turkey via the existing oil pipeline right-of-way from Kirkuk up to Ceyhan. Anyway, I just want you to know that we are working very actively on trying to attract the necessary investment to stimulate gas production in Iraq, and I think our Turkish allies will agree that energy cooperation is becoming a very positive element in Turkey's own efforts to strengthen its relationships with Iraq. Energy, though, is only one aspect of the growing economic partnership between the U.S. and Turkey. It's a crucial one. But we need to develop our trade relationship deeper. And every time Secretary Tuzman is here in Washington, we hear nonstop how important it is that we elevate that trading relationship. We do more. The volume needs to be higher. He's right. True. The good news is my friend and colleague, Assistant Secretary of State for Economic and Business Affairs and Energy Affairs, Dan Sullivan, along with Undersecretary Upacon, Chair Economic Partnership Council or Committee, which is a lot more than just empty words and boring meetings in some overheated room. We really are making progress in removing investment obstacles and stimulating a more meaningful, deeper trading relationship, which means higher volumes. So anyway, the first cluster of interests that you see in the shared vision document is about energy and economics. Second cluster of interests in that shared vision document is security. We have an impressive record of cooperation already that obviously dates back several decades. If we just talk about Iraq, Turkey was already making major contributions to Iraq's stabilization even before that November 5th meeting last year between President Bush and Prime Minister Erdogan. Turkey has been a leader and, in fact, the one that conceived of the Iraq Neighbors process, and it has been training political parties in Iraq for quite some time, which has contributed to normalization of Iraq's political life. And, of course, the logistical support that Turkey provides is crucial in terms of the fuel and the water and the food that go and electricity that is used by coalition forces but by the Iraqi people themselves. Also on security, I already mentioned in Afghanistan, Turkey's important contributions leading ISAF and Provincial Reconstruction Team. And I'm so happy to note that during last month's Afghanistan conference in Paris, Turkey doubled its pledge of assistance from $100 million to $200 million for humanitarian assistance. We should also keep in mind the important role of Turkey's private sector, Abdullah, of course. They've invested $1.5 billion in projects in Afghanistan since 2002. This includes schools, mosques, hospitals, health clinics, bridges, water wells. And now, Turkey is leading an effort to create a special investment zone along Afghanistan's border with Pakistan. And hopefully that will play an important role in helping to stabilize that volatile region. In the Middle East, I've already mentioned Turkey's close and constructive relations with Israel, as well as with Arab neighbors, which enable Turkey to play a constructive role in encouraging the peace process. On the economic front, Turkey is working with Israel and the Palestinians to build an industrial estate in the southern West Bank, which, when established, will generate economic development and job opportunities for Palestinians. On the political front, Turkey helped make last winter's Annapolis conference a success in encouraging Syria to attend even without Iran present. As we know, Turkey is now facilitating a new round of indirect discussions between Syria and Israel. In these ways, Turkey demonstrates its indispensability in helping the Euro-Atlantic community better understand the broader Middle East and develop successful strategies to advance peace and freedom in this extended region. On Iran, well, of course we recognize Turkey's long-standing relationship with its southern neighbor and their economic ties and the 1 million Iranian tourists that come to Turkey every summer. We also look to Ankara as a regional leader to continue to reinforce the international community's demand that Iran cease its nuclear enrichment programs. These demands have been expressed, as we all know, in numerous UN Security Council resolutions. And moving forward, we anticipate the strong commitment of Turkey and all our friends in the international community to send the message to the regime in Tehran that we are united in pressing Iran to change its behavior. I don't say this as an admonition. We're working great with Turkey in this regard. But we need to make sure we sustain this and don't allow any gaps to develop in our unity. We anticipate Turkey will also maintain and deepen its close ties with Israel based on these two countries' shared democratic values. As I said, Turkey is already making some important contributions to maintaining the peace and restoring stability, including in Israel's northern neighbor, Lebanon. And again, as I said, Turkey can play an important role in supporting economic growth in the Palestinian territories. In Europe, the United States remains convinced that Turkey's eventual membership in the European Union will benefit Europe and Turkey alike. We're not a member of the EU, obviously. It's not our club. We would never suggest that the membership criteria of the EU should adjust for Turkey. In fact, it is that quest to achieve EU accession that provides a very important catalyst or stimulus for Turkey's political leaders to take tough decisions that keep reform on track. Yes, we understand, we hear, we believe it when Turkey's leaders say that these reforms are moving forward because they're for the good of Turkey. We don't doubt that. But we also understand that when politicians have to make difficult decisions, it's quite useful if there's a grander, broad strategic goal on the horizon. And it is EU accession and not privileged partnership, in our humble opinion, that provides that catalyst. Cyprus is obviously closely connected to Turkey's EU accession prospects. And everybody knows in this room our policy. We're firmly committed to doing everything we can to support the reunification of Cyprus into a bizonal, bicommunal federation. That's the only way to have a lasting settlement. And we are quite pleased. Oh, and that settlement, by the way, process needs to build on the body of work that has been elaborated for the past several decades in endless, it seems, rounds of negotiations about Cyprus. With every, as my wife tells me, every new negotiator that shows up to take his or her hand at the Cyprus problem thinks they've got the brand new ideas, and one leader or the other always says, that's been tried, that was tried in 73, that was tried in 82. And every idea seems to get shot down from the outset, but now perhaps there is a different spirit that is pervading both sides of the island. Maybe that's what's evident in the discussions between the leaders, Christofias and Talat. You know that they met in March, and that led to the reopening of the Leader Street crossing in the center of Nicosia. And you probably also know that technical working groups or technical committees and working groups are underway, setting the agenda for what we hope will be resumed comprehensive settlement talks under UN auspices, hopefully within the next month or so. They're still working through those details. We welcome the May 23rd statement by the two leaders, which set the goals being a reunified Cyprus with two constituent states, by the way, which was quite a significant gesture or statement by Mr. Christofias. And at the same time, while we're ready to do whatever it takes to support the UN, we believe that Cyprus settlement must be one that is born, created on the island by the Cypriots themselves. So we're not rushing ahead to appoint a special envoy. We want to see what happens with the United Nations, and we want to see how comfortable the partners are with the process. And if they both decide it's time for there to be a U.S. mediator who could be helpful, well, then we'll appoint such a mediator. The idea, though, is we want the parties themselves to be generating the ideas, to be generating a new plan into which they themselves will buy. On Armenia, we share our European allies' hope that Turkey and Armenia will soon normalize their relations. This will involve a decision by Turkey to restore diplomatic relations and reopen its border with Armenia, as well as Armenia's recognition of the existing border with Turkey. Just today, there was a very positive development in which President Serge Sarkisian of Armenia announced that he was going to invite Prime Minister Erdogan to Armenia to watch the World Cup qualifying match in a couple of weeks between Turkey and Armenia. I can't stop smiling. It's an amazing development that seemed impossible a few months ago. I, for whatever it's worth, spend a lot of time with President Sarkisian. I'll see him on Saturday and find him to think a little bit differently than his predecessor. It's not all sweetness and light, but I found when he and President Aliyev got together a couple of weeks ago in St. Petersburg, it seemed these were two leaders that think in a much more similar way than was the case with Sarkisian's predecessor, Ilham Aliyev. Both leaders of Armenia and Azerbaijan now seem to be pragmatic, practical, and ready to explore each side's needs when it comes to Nagorno-Karabakh settlement. So hopefully I'll do my job relatively effectively, and we'll see a framework agreement on Nagorno-Karabakh later this year. But we got a ways to go. Briefly, in the Black Sea region, especially in Georgia, Turkey has a very important role to play, particularly with regard to Abkhazia. I right now I'm leaving in a couple hours to go back to Europe to work on emerging negotiation process to try to create a long-standing, just, and lasting settlement of the Abkhazia conflict. This is not easy. Russia has not been helpful. It's been provocative. It has been obstructing efforts by the Georgians and the Abkhaz to get together, to talk to each other. Turkey's own Abkhaz diaspora can play an important role in using investment and economic cooperation to rebuild ties between the Abkhaz and the rest of Georgia. Turkey leads Operation Black Sea Harmony in the Black Sea, and the United States strongly supports that. It's an operation that involves all the littoral states, including Russia, but Romania, Ukraine, Bulgaria, Georgia, focusing on combating the threats of terrorism and proliferation. And we strongly welcome the sharing of information between Operation Black Sea Harmony, and NATO's own Operation Active Endeavor in the Mediterranean Sea. Finally, get into the end here. Okay, I got time. Third cluster of common interests that we talk about in our shared vision document is the advance of democratic and market economic reform, which reflects the values that our two countries share. We talk about shared values and common interests. The other stuff, the security, the energy, that's about common interests. The internal reform is really about shared values. The legacy, well, Turkey's unique historical experience makes clear that it cannot be a model for any country. It's not a model, it's unique. But its legacy of over a century and a half of modernizing reforms can inspire those in Iraq and the rest of the broader Middle East and beyond who seek the same political and economic freedoms as Turkey's citizens have come to enjoy. The democratic system that Mustafa Kemal Atatürk launched 85 years ago affords Turkey its greatest strategic significance in this day and age. It's democracy that really makes Turkey count to us, at least in this administration, more than anything else. It's precisely that advance of democracy, secularism, and the rule of law that can ensure separation of mosque and state and advance political and individual freedoms while blunting the efforts of extremist recruiters. We welcome the Turkish government's reform of Article 301 of the Penal Code and look forward to a new and invigorated effort to enact further reforms that will help Turkey fulfill its EU aspirations. Of course, the economic reforms launched by President Turgut Özal in the 80s have helped transform Turkey into one of the most promising emerging markets in the entire world. Sound fiscal policies have allowed Turkey to weather severe financial crises in the 1990s and most severely in 2001, and to orient its economy toward fulfilling its own EU aspirations. We support the Turkish government as it pursues this reform agenda. As President Bush himself said following the EU-US summit in Slovenia on June 10th, quote, "We strongly believe Turkey ought to be a member of the EU and appreciate Turkey's record of democratic and free market reforms and working to realize its EU aspirations." I know, again, my EU colleagues don't like to hear our own government pronouncing on who ought to be in the EU, but the point about that quote is that it is the reforms that we hope to see moving forward and recognize, again, the prospect of membership in the EU as a catalyst for those reforms. But as we know from our own experience here in the United States, building democracy is a job that's never done. Political ideologies must adjust to broader societal change. It took our own country nearly a century first to abolish slavery, and now, 145 years later, only now, has an African American emerged as a top presidential candidate. In Turkey, some political leaders argue they're trying to adjust the vision of Mustafa Kemal Atatürk to a new era. Opponents contend these efforts aim to undermine Kemalism and the constitutional principles of secularism, democracy, and the rule of law. The current closure case against the ruling AK Party is where these arguments obviously come to a head. What's clear to me, as a U.S. official, is that Turkey's democratic system is the product of Turkey's own historical experience and remains vibrant. As in the past, Turkish democracy will work through this current and difficult challenge. In the end, a democracy requires that voters determine their country's political future, and Turkey's voters made clear decisions during elections twice in 2007. At the same time, Turkish leaders, including President Gül and Prime Minister Erdogan, have underscored the crucial importance of maintaining the separation of mosque and state through the constitutional principle of secularism as a central element of Turkey's democratic system. Ultimately, we're confident that our Turkish allies will rely on their own Anatolian traditions of pragmatism and tolerant faith, combined with modern embrace of scientific learning, to resolve the current controversy in a way that strengthens Turkish democracy. In conclusion and in summary, U.S.-Turkish relations now enjoy a new and modern agenda, which differs profoundly from our partnership during the Cold War era. We've reshaped our bilateral agenda radically during the administration of George W. Bush. Having weathered some serious difficulties, the U.S.-Turkey strategic partnership is broader and richer than any time in the past. Our relations are based on common interests and shared values. Today, the United States appreciates Turkey as a key Euro-Atlantic ally that uniquely enjoys multiple identities as a European, Middle Eastern, Eurasian, Balkan, Black Sea, and Mediterranean country. Our cooperation on energy, security, and democracy provide the foundation for a partnership that is more deeply and genuinely strategic than any time in the past. As we contemplate the threats that will confront the Euro-Atlantic community in the coming decades, Turkey has emerged as an indispensable partner. Maximizing the potential of our strategic partnership will require the next administration to keep all these factors in mind and require Turkey to sustain political and economic reforms, even when tempted by its propensity to avoid tough decisions. Thank you very much.